Welcome back to the Grid Talk podcast. This is episode 172. My name is Tom Horrocks, and today we'll continue our fireside chat series with a special guest to talk about the upcoming Formula One season. Joining us today, we have Jake Boxall-Legg from Autosport to talk us through some of the more technical elements of the new regulations. Hi, Jake. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it. It's been an interesting testing season, so I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about.
Yeah, and we might even be allowed to call it testing by the end of this. You never know. For those of you who don't know who this person is, who's on the other end of my Zoom call, who are you and what is it that you do?
So I'm Jake, as you have so kindly introduced me as. So I'm the technical editor at Autosport. So I'm covering all kinds of technical things that, you know, that happen in Formula One and sometimes in other championships as well. Also this year, I'm covering Formula E as the on-the-ground reporter as well. So I'm sort of all over lots of different parts of motorsport. So I have a lot on my plate, but it's always really good fun.
Yeah, it's not fun trying to cover more than one motorsport. I've tried that before and it's quite difficult, but I can't wait to get into that. If you just make sure you subscribe to us on YouTube by clicking the bell and you'll be notified whenever we go live. And don't forget to give us a thumbs up as well. If you enjoy our show, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify now. You can do that as well, as it really helps us climb the charts. But speaking of climbing the charts, everyone is expecting to be a lot better this year with the new regulations. So getting straight into it, what is it that you think is the biggest change this year? And what is it that makes you most excited / worried about the upcoming season?
I think it's the fact that everybody has had to come up with something completely different for these new 2022 regulations. Obviously, it's a huge change in terms of the aerodynamics, the way that everything worked before doesn't really transfer to what they do now. And it's just interesting to see how every single team has adapted to this clean sheet design, if you like. Nothing that they could use from last year can be carried over. You'd seen the cars from the last few years sort of be evolutions of each other, have the same kind of style. That's all changed now. And I think one of the biggest things that is visible on the new cars is perhaps how the front end looks now attaching to the front wing. The huge variation in side pod designs, for example, as well. As for things that make me worried, is it going to be this silver bullet for the overtaking that we want? One of the things we saw in testing, or the shakedown as F1 officially wants to call it, been the porpoising of the cars on the straights, which I'm sure we'll get into a little bit later as well, which sort of makes me a little bit worried as well for the drivers in particular. I'm quietly confident that we'll see some really good races with these cars. I mean, for the most part, I think they look absolutely spectacular. They look aggressive. They look like Formula One cars, and they sort of have that hint of almost the late 80s, early 90s in them, which I really, really like. So I'm looking forward to seeing how they actually, you know, race when it comes to the first race in Bahrain.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about the looks of the cars and seeing the times that have been coming through in practice. And I know it's a bit early to talk about times and everything, but it seems like it's going to be both sexy and fast this year. I was a bit worried we were going to have like 10-second a lap slower cars, but it's certainly not proved the case at all, as we've only been a couple of seconds off Barcelona times from last season, which was really great to see. But obviously, you were in Barcelona. What was that like being? I mean, obviously, I know you've done it before, but what was that like being there for the launch of this entirely new formula?
There was this very sort of tangible key and sense of anticipation in the media room. Everyone was really looking forward to seeing how these cars did. We were all waiting to see who the first car to come out was, and I can't even remember who it was at this point. I think it might have been a Mercedes.
I think it was Lando, because
have been a McLaren, actually. Yeah,
bit of a fanboy, so yeah, I was looking out for that.
So yeah, it was really interesting to see these cars finally hit the road and see what they do and kind of understand them as they went around the track. Yeah, it was a really good feeling to sort of be there for the sort of dawn of these new cars as well. I mean, obviously having, you know, I've done I think the last test I did was 2020. I couldn't really do 2021 because of some small global events there. It had a different feeling to that, because that sort of felt like a continuation of whatever 2019 brought. Yeah, this feels completely new, and everyone was sort of falling over themselves to see who was good, who wasn't good. Naturally, obviously, we have no idea still. I don't think we'll know until we get to Bahrain, but yeah, there was just sort of like that very keen sense of anticipation from everybody, I think.
Yeah, and it's great that obviously you get to witness that firsthand. It's just a shame that there was no fans there to witness it with you. I know it's not exactly ever a sellout, Barcelona, but especially testing, but given everything that we've seen last season and the trajectory that Formula One's on, I think it potentially could have been a pretty decent selling test. What's your opinion on that? I mean, what were the reasons as to why it was behind closed doors? There's lots of rumours about money and you know, teams not wanting to be embarrassed, but what's your take on it?
I'm sort of split, to be honest with you. You know, as somebody who works at F1 sort of tangentially, I would never say testing is a particularly fantastic spectacle. It's just cars going around endlessly. But I kind of also get, you know, why you would want to be there. And every year that we go, usually there's lots of fans that have turned up, especially for the event. And there were still fans that had turned up to hang outside the gates, which, you know, I admire that level of sort of that dedication. At the same time, yeah, it was, at the end of the day, it was probably money. Bahrain offered a lot of money to host the official test, and this was essentially just a shakedown. I think Formula One kind of thought that it would be like the tests of old, where it's all behind closed doors and teams could just spend a lot of time troubleshooting and that kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, I think they were also worried that things wouldn't work out straight out of the box, and they did. I mean, the internals of the car, they're not too far removed from what we have now. So I don't think that should have ever been a worry. But yeah, I think they were just sort of worried that we'd fans would be sat in the grandstands waiting for one of the 10 cars to pop out and not doing so, but that didn't prove to be the case anyway.
I mean, you talk about the internals of the car being the same. There is one thing that has changed, which is the thing that's powering them, the E10 fuel. I don't know if this kind of fits within your remit or your understanding, but it's something that I've not quite got my head around about what the difference is with this year's fuel to last year's. What for you is the difference, and how does it affect the cars?
So what you've got now in the new fuel is E10. The 10 stands for 10% bioethanol. So obviously it's a step towards e-fuels and more sustainable fuels for the future. One of Formula One's sort of big, I guess, problems over the next 10 years is deciding, you know, what it wants to be, how it wants to be, how it wants to be propelled. Because obviously worldwide, you have a lot of countries saying that they want to stop the sale of internal combustion engine powered cars, that sort of thing. And so Formula One's looking for alternatives. And it's, do you go to a full electric formula? Do you sort of go with an electric powertrain, but have a hydrogen fuel cell powering it? Or are you going to invest in synthetic and drop in fuels that still work with internal combustion engine, but, you know, produce so many emissions and don't, you know, create so many emissions in trying to produce them? So it's sort of part of that sort of shift. And I think, you know, when we move into 2026, if it's not, you know, all bioethanol or something like that, or all sustainable fuels, I think Formula One would have missed a trick. But I think that's what they're shooting for going into the future.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, it's certainly visually, I know obviously the amount of fuel that we use getting the circus on the road is, you know, it absolutely dwarfs what we actually use for the races themselves. But certainly politically, it would look a lot better for Formula One if they were using fuels that are a lot more economical, even if it helps with the development of those fuels for other cars. Because even if we stop selling internal combustion engine cars, people are still gonna, you know, they're still gonna own their old bangers. And I know my dad's got a Jag E-Type that he's never going to get rid of. And, you know, what are you going to do with cars like that? You need something that's going to replace that fuel and without killing the planet as well. So definitely a good thing for Formula One to be pushing towards. Back to, you know, the cars going fast, which is what we care about. Obviously the lap times, you know, we don't really look at the lap times, but they're not too far removed from last year. But what's your opinion on how it's going to affect them at different circuits? Obviously Barcelona, very very specific type of circuit, which is very different to Bahrain and then Monaco and Monza. How do you think the cars are going to react differently on those other circuits?
I think one of the things that we saw, particularly in the first sector at Bahrain, when you look at turn three, it's quite a sort of fast sweeping corner. Mm. The cars are going to be absolutely spectacular around those corners because these new Venturi tunnels that they have on the underfloor, they produce so much downforce and they're just sucking the car to the road. And it just means they can go so much quicker around these corners. And so in circuits like that, circuits like Monza, maybe even circuits like Zandvoort and a few others, they're going to look so, so good. My worry is with the circuits like Monaco and Hungary, where everything's a lot slower. So these Venturi tunnels don't have as much top speed to work. And so they're not producing anywhere near the amount of downforce. And so it's going to be, I worry that it's going to look a little bit glacial from that perspective anyway. But around Barcelona, yeah, in that first sector and in perhaps around turn nine as well, they did look pretty spectacular. I didn't see too much of the on-track action because I was helping coordinate the Autosport Live efforts, because obviously nobody really had much of a way of watching testing. So it was kind of up to us to show what kind of the times were and who was doing what and that kind of thing. As you say, the times aren't too far removed. You know, we're probably a couple seconds down, but at the same time, the cars weren't really pushing either. Nobody was really absolutely going for it. We ended up in the 118s by the end. You know, it's about 2.5-3 seconds off the ultimate lap time that teams were doing last year on the absolute softs. But again, they're not really pushing. So the time deficit isn't too much. And with development, it will only, you know, the deficit will only shrink.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced they were pushing at all, given that, like, the times they were putting straight out of the block, and then 3 days later, and they weren't going that much quicker. So I can't see that they were really going full beans at all. It's more kind of systems checks and you know, understanding as opposed to, you know, chasing times and everything like that. They're going to be more focused on that in Bahrain, as that's where we actually start the season. But if we actually go on talking about cars themselves now, we'll just kind of work through them in championship order, I think, starting with the Mercedes. I mean, it's silver. We noticed that. I'm kind of torn on that one. I really like the black, but also it's nice to see the silver return. Color aside, what's your opening thoughts about the Mercedes car itself?
Well, I think, first of all, the thoughts of other people seem to be that it looks really simple, and I don't entirely see that. I think it's just a sort of a baseline car when it comes to testing, and we're expecting them to bring quite a few more updates for Bahrain, whether it'll be like a Spain 2019 situation where they turned up with a very visibly different car from one day to the next. I'm not entirely sure, but it what it crucially had, especially over last year, when you look at Bahrain testing, for example, there was a very, very long period of time where the Mercedes were spending their time, you know, in the garage trying to work on things because it was not particularly reliable. What they've got this year is reliability out of the box. And on the final day, for example, Lewis Hamilton was just clocking in lap after lap on the sort of wet, drying track when they'd wetted the track for wet weather testing. It just looks reliable and it looks strong. And I guess that's everything we kind of expect from Mercedes. And yeah, I think aerodynamically we'll see some updates and we'll see the car become a little bit more complex, but what it does have, it's got some sort of really sort of interesting little design solutions to the new cars. It looks like a very, very strong contender. So yeah, I think I'm sort of quietly impressed with what they've been able to do. I think we'll definitely see more from them in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, I think if I think we've learned one thing since 2014 about Mercedes is they know how to test. They know how to put a testing program together. They've never once really looked like, I think one year they looked slightly on the back foot, and that was when Ferrari just came out and as an absolute rocket ship. But even so, you still had this belief that they were going to catch up. Even last year, you still had this belief there that they're not just going to design a bad car, are they? But yeah, I think probably almost a B-spec car will be following in the first official test, definitely. But Red Bull, they seem to have completely changed their car from the pictures they launched within the 2 weeks later to the testing. Totally different car design. I've not seen much of this myself. I've not seen a lot of pictures on track, but the first thing I noticed was the hugely aggressive side pods that just seemed like you could put your dinner on those things. What stood out for you with the Red Bull?
Well, first of all, I'll say that I was quite furious about that launch because to promise an RB18 and then basically just paint the F1 show car and you go, here it is. It's very, very cheeky. And I wasn't a massive fan of that. But then when we did see the car, yeah, as you say, the side pods were hugely aggressive. There was this massive undercut around the sort of front inlet, if you like. And this just is all part of the solution on how to get this new floor design to work best. And everybody's doing a lot of weird and crazy things with their side pods to move the cooling around, create the sort of space underneath the floor to, you know, try and derive more downforce, and that's just one of their solutions. And you know, if you look sort of further back, you can see the side pods are sort of quite flat sided. Obviously packaging is very, very crucial in this area. It is an interesting car. You can see that they've concentrated a lot more of their cooling towards the sort of the center line of the car and using the overhead intake to produce that cooling effect so they can shrink the side pods more. Everything else sort of looked in its place. You know, there wasn't, other than that, there probably wasn't too much to say about it. I think, again, like Mercedes, they'll bring more things to Bahrain. So it'll be interesting to see how that car develops and how that sort of metamorphosizes over the coming weeks again, because these two teams, we expect them to be in the hunt for the championship. I don't think that we'll suddenly see this drop off, even with the new cars.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised that Red Bull put out such a pitiful attempt at saying it was a launch. It was in my opinion, a bit of an insult to the intelligence of the viewers to say, yes, this is our car, when clearly it wasn't. And for such a rapid redesign in 2 weeks, just yeah, a bit of a kick in the teeth to the hardcore fans, I think. But yeah, it's I don't know how you feel about this, but my opinion of Red Bull, I actually predicted them to finish third or fourth in the championship this year because of my opinion, they always tend to start slowly. And it just seemed like they were putting much more into the last season than Mercedes were. And Mercedes were, you know, given that they put hardly any updates into their previous year's car, into their 2021 car, because the 2020 car was so strong. And then to switch off development so early to this car, surely they must have absolutely mastered the regulations, because a team like Mercedes spending that much time on a car, surely they're going to have an absolute world beater. So, yes, yeah, so I just fully expect the Mercedes to have brought an absolute world beater to the season this year. But it seems like Red Bull and Ferrari and McLaren indeed do seem to be a lot closer than I was expecting anyway. But, you know, what do I know? I'm not exactly an expert in the field. But one thing that I did predict right is that Ferrari their trajectory would continue, and they do seem to be onto a bit of a winner at the moment. What's your opinion on Ferrari? It seems to be very, very different to everything else that's come out.
In terms of aesthetics, I really, really like it. I think it looks like a 90s Ferrari. It looks, there's so many sort of like little design elements that just look fantastic. And the livery as well, the black wings, for example, again, 90s, it's fantastic. I really, really like it. The striking thing is these massive side pods with the big divot in the top. And that's a solution that we've not really seen, we weren't really expecting. And again, this is a situation of how they're packaging their cooling solutions. And we saw this was particularly with Alpine last year, that big engine cover, because they were concentrating all the cooling elements in the center. And we've seen teams like in Red Bull and Williams as well do that, so they can shrink the side pods. Ferrari's gone completely the other direction. They've gone for these big side pods with a very, very small overhead cooling inlet and intake inlet, so that they can focus their cooling on the side pods. And so you've got these massive fins or gills or whatever you want to call them in the bodywork, and so they can make the very rear end very, very tight, and so they can open up all of the bodywork at the rear. So there's some really interesting elements at play with this Ferrari, and the front end is really interesting as well. If you look at the nose cone, for example, the very, very front part of that, the tip the wing attaches to, that's completely interchangeable as well. It's like a modular design, so they focused all the crash tests on the bit that attaches to the chassis, and then the very, very tip of that, they can swap it out and change it if they need to relatively quickly, rather than, you know, having to lug a big bunch of wings around every race weekend. So yeah, it's a really, really interesting design, and it's gone really well. It's the car that produced the most laps in testing as well. Charles Leclerc and Carlos Sainz looked, you know, metronomic out there, just putting mileage on the car, and it seems to be in working order. We don't know, and the drivers have said that they don't know how good it is at this point, but it must be quite good, because it's relatively consistent, and that's what the drivers need.
Yeah, there's certain elements of the car that reminded me of the sort of the 2010-11 time-ish McLaren, where they had the L-shaped side pods there. But that was sort of a slightly different design there, but very kind of... The last time I remember seeing side pods quite so sculpted to fit the car. And yeah, with the driver lineup, definitely two incredibly strong drivers. The car looks strong. It looks like it's going to be a good season for Ferrari. But, you know, they have won the testing championship on numerous occasions, and as yet in the last decade and a half they haven't won a championship, so let's wait and see. Hopefully it's brighter times ahead for Ferrari. But moving on to McLaren, the most common thing I'm hearing about this car is the whole push rod in the front pull rod in the front, push rod in the rear. I have absolutely no idea what that means. I mean, obviously I know what it physically means, but what that means for the car itself, I have no idea. But I mean, is it all about the suspension for the McLaren, or is there any other much more subtle things that we should be looking at?
I think the suspension is a bit of a small thing, really. When you consider suspension packages today, everything works pretty much very, very similar from one car to the other. It's just about how you package it from an aerodynamic standpoint. And going for the push rod at the rear, what this means is you've got the attachment point to the wheels at the very bottom, and then you're creating your tracking through the push rod, and then that rocker is being mounted to the top of the gearbox to then interact with the shocks and dampers, or the springs and dampers rather. So it's just a way of packaging it. And by moving the rockers to the top, you've got more floor space available that you don't have to sort of create a bulge for or anything like that. So you can open up more of the floor. And the pull rod at the front is something a lot of teams have experimented with over the last few years. Everybody eventually always shifts back to push rods. But I think the sort of demands of the new cars mean that it's not as cut and dried. You know, obviously it will provide some kind of vehicle dynamic or, you know, difference compared to a push rod. But I think largely in terms of packaging, it is an aerodynamic one again. And it's just being able to sort of put all of the suspension members in a sort of much tighter space so that, you know, you can open things out or direct things to go the way you want them with regards to airflow. So it's probably an aerodynamic decision rather than a kinematic decision. But it'll be interesting to see how it works out for them, certainly. I think there's still a few more sort of interesting elements on the McLaren as well. I know that the paint job has been divisive. I really like it, but I know that there are a lot of people who don't. And again, we've seen this trajectory from Lando Norris as well, just getting better and better with each season. Now that Daniel Ricciardo's had a season with McLaren to assimilate himself within the team, you know, it should be a much stronger year in theory for them if they've got the design right.
Yeah, I think the paint job response from you was the correct answer. I think it's the second best looking car on the grid. We've already covered the best looking car on the grid, and it pains me to say the Ferrari is the best looking car on the grid, but I genuinely think it is. Yeah, no, and Lando as well, amazing trajectory. I just really hope this year's works out better for Ricciardo, because he really needs a strong season this year. And talk about, again, cars that looked great. Last year's potentially best looking car on the grid, Alpine, in my opinion, which again is divisive, is now the worst looking car on the grid. I just cannot get on with that paint scheme. Paint aside, what about the Alpine? What struck you from that?
Not a massive amount, to be honest with you. I've not seen a lot from it in the first couple of days. It looked pretty solid on track. And then on the final day, Fernando Alonso did 12 laps and then the car just gave up on him. And it was very, very smoky at the back of that Alpine. I think one of the key things about it is that Renault has produced an entirely new power unit for this one. You know, they focused on getting as much performance out of it as they can, and then they'll focus on reliability. And then reliability did look good in the first couple of days. And now I'm not entirely sure where, you know, Alonso's problem that ended their day of running on the Friday puts them in terms of reliability. But it does look relatively quick. You'll see with their sort of like side pod solution, for example, they've gone sort of more of a halfway house, if you like. They've got the sort of ramped elements that's bringing more airflow down towards the rear. Everything looks relatively conventional. Whether it's the car that will bring Fernando Alonso a win again, that after many, many years, we'll have to wait and see. But I think it probably end up being on balance a little bit more of the same from them, fighting in the midfield, that kind of thing. They'll want to be more consistent, because that was one of the big problems they had last year with consistency. Either they were, you know, in the points and Ocon was getting a win, or, you know, they're P11, P12. So they need to sort of find a happy medium there and sort of damp their results out a little bit.
Yeah, well, Bottas is going to be a bit further back, so he's not going to be able to give them a win this time. He's going to be taken out the back of the field instead of the front of the field this time. But yeah, no, it's one of those cars I just not really see an awful lot of. Obviously, it's not been on track a lot either. I heard people saying that it was audibly much quieter than the other cars, but that might have just been the Renault power unit. But we've obviously got nothing to compare it with. I heard rumours towards the end of last year and the start, you know, but on the run into this year, that Alpine were the team that had found that golden bullet to propel them up the order. And I was kind of expecting to see Fernando Alonso coming out swinging and absolutely loving life, but that just hasn't transpired at all yet. So I'm hoping that they certainly do have a bit more of a consistent season and can fight up there with the big boys. But honestly, I just have no faith in the Renault organization and their ability to put a winning program together anymore. It just seems too top heavy in politics and too many people, too many cooks spoiling the broth, personally for me. But again, what do I know? Absolutely nothing. But another car that I think is absolutely beautiful looking car, but I've not seen a lot from it, is the AlphaTauri. But it's obviously the sister car to the Red Bull. It's got very different philosophies all across the car to the Red Bull this year, which has surprised me.
Yeah, I think there's sort of like some similarities, but with regards to suspension and things like that, they've gone in very much the same way as they did last year. And as you know, AlphaTauri takes Red Bull suspension, but you know, they've continued to persist with the direction of last year. With regards to the car itself, there's sort of Red Bull influences in the side pods, but perhaps not as extreme. Look at the front wing on the AlphaTauri is quite, you know, compared to the other teams, a little bit more extreme than perhaps others. Interesting to see, we'll see how they're directing airflow out and that kind of thing. But the car has been really quite reliable. And Pierre Gasly's done a lot of running. Yuki Tsunoda did a lot of running on the first day. Unfortunately, Tsunoda couldn't do any laps on Friday because Gasly crashed at turn five and they weren't able to get the car sort of ready and up and running again, which is a bit of a shame. It would have put a bit of a dent in their testing program. But I think, again, this is a team that does quite a lot with a little. They've really streamlined their organization in the last couple of years. You know, they've gone, why are we building suspension components and gearboxes and that kind of thing when we can just buy them in from up the road and free up our resources for other things? Which I think is a really, really smart way of going about battling in the midfield, because since they started moving on towards that program, we've seen them really sort of cement themselves as a midfield force. And they were very, very nearly in with the shout of getting fifth overall last season. So they're just very, very sensible with the way that they do things there. And we know how good Pierre Gasly is. He's really picked up from the sort of Red Bull disappointment and he's just delivers week in, week out. And I think with regards to Yuki Tsunoda, we've certainly not seen the best of what he can do. I do rate him personally. I think he can be fantastic. It's just getting him to realize that, but at the same time, not overinflating his ego, which was, I think, the problem at the start of last year where he thought, oh, this is easy, I can do it. And then when the hard times hit, he was like, I don't know what to do now. And his confidence just dropped. So it's up to them to sort of keep him on an even keel and just, you know, hungry and fight for points and things like that.
Yeah, it's very much feast or famine for the AlphaTauri team. They're very much a dark horse, not say for the championship, but very much an unknown quantity coming into this year. And the whole philosophy of buying everything in from Red Bull was very much opposite what James Key was trying to put together. I think he was just worried that Red Bull were going to pull out at a moment's notice and he wanted the team to continue. But obviously, you know, what they were looking to do long term didn't really fit in with what he wanted, which is why eventually he jumped ship to McLaren. But another car that, for me, that the first car that came out that we saw properly, the Aston Martin, never for me has a car aged so quickly. I when I first saw it, I thought, wow, if this is what Formula One's going to look like, it's great. And now at the end of it, I look at it, I just think that looks old to me. It looks, is it just a case of that they just, have they got more stuff coming, or is it that they've that it's just that, you know, the recency bias of the fact that they were the first out, they now kind of looks a bit more dated, and have they kind of gone with their design too early, or, you know, could they have maybe put a few more weeks into developments?
They'll certainly have some stuff coming for sure. I think everybody will to a degree. What happens when you design a car is you usually set a point around sort of November, December time where you say, this is where we freeze our design. This is what we're going to build for the first test. And then everything we design after that, that'll go in the pipeline, the tests and the first few races and that kind of thing. But it is a very interesting design. From top down, those side pods look absolutely huge with the huge gills on top. But if you look at it kind of side on, you know, down the flanks, there's this big undercut, and it kind of works in the same way as, you know, side pods in the past have done in sort of channeling the airflow towards the rear of the car, which is what aerodynamics is trying to do. But they've also sort of matched that with this very, very high nose in comparison to the rest of the other cars as well. And that's sort of something that they've plowed their own furrow on, I think. No one else has sort of really gone for that. They've also sort of gone for like the little spoon-shaped front wings, and Aston Martin's gone in a different direction. Obviously, I think one of the other sort of pertinent parts of the team is the changes at the top as well. Obviously, Otmar Safnauer has gone, and Mike Krack has come in from the BMW sports car project. I think they were trying to replicate the signing of Andreas Seidel and what he's done for McLaren in rebirthing the team. They wanted somebody with a little bit of outside knowledge that can come in and sort of whip the team into shape. this was a team that historically has, again, done a lot with a little. And now they've got this money from Lawrence Stroll and Aston Martin. It's like, do they know what to do with it? Do they know how to spend it efficiently? And that's something that they need to come to terms with. I do like the car. I think it looks really interesting. Whether it's quick, I don't know. And again, it was another car that ran quite reliably. And then Sebastian Vettel had a blowout on the final day, and that kind of put a spanner in the works a little bit for them.
Yeah, I think they'll be just fine. I don't think they're going to be pushing top four, but I think they'll be I think they'll be okay. I think there's too many good people there, and they've put too much into this car for it to be an absolute dog. So I think it's I think it'll be fine. Moving on to the Williams, finished eighth in the championship last year. Most disappointing for me with this car was just the fact that they've removed the Senna logo off the nose cone, which was a bit disappointing for me, but I'll try not to dwell on it too much. But yeah, what were your thoughts with the Williams? It's quite a striking car, I think.
Yeah, it is. When I first saw it, there were two things that jumped out at me. First of all, paint scheme, it looks like a Neo from Formula E. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it was the nose, which looks incredibly similar to the FW13 from 1989/1990. It looks like a massive throwback, which I like. And then you look at the side pods and it's sort of gone in a very similar fashion to the Mercedes, sort of like a relatively open sort of front part, and then just really tucks in behind that. I really, really hope that Williams is able to continue on this upward trajectory now, because last year, when you consider that car that they had was supposed to be, well, it was obviously a development of the FW43 2020, which was a development of the god-awful car from 2019. When you consider that they were getting points with it on a regular, well, not a regular basis, but they were getting points with it, that's such a good turnaround. And now that they've got all the what is seemingly the right people in charge, hopefully, you know, they're on the right step. And Alex Albon as well coming in for George Russell, I think, you know, you lose George Russell and it's a big loss. But I think in terms of like for like replacements, I think Albon's probably the best that they'll get. I think, you know, he's very, very underrated. I think his reputation took a little bit of a battering with Red Bull. But when you look at Sergio Perez, for example, and we know how good he is, relative to Max Verstappen, is he doing any better? Not a huge, maybe like a tenth a lap, but not a massive turnaround. So I think they've got a very, very good driver.
Yeah, I mean, I think this all stems back to when Gasly effectively blew his chance, and I think he probably has to take some responsibility for how that went down. But he was a built-in perfect number two for Max Verstappen, and it just didn't work out for whatever reason. And Red Bull have never really found a solution to that, and I still don't think that Perez is the absolute solution, or he certainly hasn't proved it, but maybe with this new car he may well do. I think for me Williams's biggest problem is that they don't have George Russell anymore, and it really is it's an important season for Latifi, because was Russell that good, or, you know, is Latifi purely a pay driver? I guess we'll find out, because Albon's no slouch, as you say. I think probably if they can maintain eighth place, then they'll probably be happy with that. But so long as they're in the fight and they're not adrift like they were last season. Moving on to the Alfa Romeo, ninth place last season. Very, very secretive of their car. You know, the camo livery, which looked great, but we never saw the car. So they were like being doubly careful to make sure no one saw what they were doing. So from what you can tell from the car, from what you've seen of it, what's your thoughts?
Been a difficult Barcelona for Alfa Romeo. They had a good period on the second day where newcomer Guan Yu Zhou was able to get quite a few laps in, but laps have been at a premium. Every time, you know, Valtteri Bottas got in the car, things just kind of seemed to go wrong for him. You know, I think maybe the best he got in the day was like 20 laps or something like that.
Classic Bottas.
Yeah, it's been a difficult time. I'm intrigued by the car. It's very, again, they've really sort of gone with their own direction. One of the things that they've done over the off-season is reduce their technical partnership with Ferrari so that they can go their own way with regards to gearbox and suspension design at the rear. And then like Aston Martin, they've got these, you know, these big old side pods with a big old undercut. And then if you look at the sort of front end as well, it looks incredibly complex, the front wing. So I'm just intrigued to see when that car is turning in laps on a consistent basis, how good it's going to be. With Bottas, what they do have is a driver who is going to be a very good benchmark of where the car is, you know, in terms of, in pace terms. If a car is capable of sixth place, he'll, you know, he'll put it in sixth place. So that's someone dependable that Alfa has. And then for Guan Yu Zhou, coming in now, Bottas is a fantastic benchmark for him. Obviously, he's got getting a little bit of flack for bringing all of this money from China and that sort of thing. But I think he's a very solid driver and he'll do a good job. He's not going to embarrass himself, which I think is the absolute key thing. So I'm looking forward to seeing this car run properly and see how good it is when it does. Otherwise, it might be a difficult year again and we'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah, I've got high hopes for Alfa Romeo. Regular listeners to Grid Talk will know of my absolute just complete vanilla-ness towards the Alfa Romeo operation over the last few years. And I would always get Alfa Romeo to talk about in the race reviews and it was always just like, ugh, where do I start? But no, I'm quite excited about Alfa Romeo this year because two new drivers, just a whole kind of new, not a new team as such, but a whole kind of new ethos and way to go racing. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that pans out. And the car looks good as well. Best looking Alfa Romeo since they've come back into the sport for me. But just as long as they just have a purpose for me and a reason to go racing, then I'm happy. But they just haven't had that for a few years. So, and a team that's very lucky to even still be on the grid, it seems, at the moment, with all the problems that they've had in Haas. I think the biggest thing for me this year for them, politics aside, is the extra help they're getting from Ferrari, and they've really got some good people in the right places there. And given that they completely sacked off last year, I think the signs are good for Haas if they can keep the thing going. What's your thoughts?
I think I'd agree with that, to be honest with you. If you look at the car's sort of details, it's very well developed at the moment. Obviously, as you say, they put all of their eggs into this basket, and so they've had more time than everyone else with sort of a full development force working on it. And so, yeah, little details around the front end, that kind of thing, really interesting to see them in comparison to other teams. They've gone for sort of like similar side pods to Ferrari, and you can see that influence in the design. As you say, they've got a hub at Maranello explicitly for Haas, which is being led by Simone Resta, who's a former Alfa Romeo and Ferrari designer. So they've got, as you say, all the right people in place. It is just, again, a matter of reliability. Mazepin had a fuel pump problem on one day. Mick Schumacher has an issue with the floor and some sensor issues on another day. It's just kind of, it's been this perfect storm of issues. And then obviously on the final day, it turns up in a completely plain white livery owing to outside influences. So it's been a very, very difficult Barcelona for Haas. It's unclear where they go forward from here, especially with regards to drivers. Is Mazepin going to be in that car in Bahrain? We don't know. The suggestion is that he won't, but we don't know that for sure at the moment. So it's a team we'll have to keep our eye on for sure.
Yeah, at the time of recording this, we are recording this on Wednesday, the 3rd of March. So we may well have a bit more clarity by the time this actually airs, which will be on the eve of testing for us next week. But yeah, it may well be Oscar Piastri in that car. Who knows? We can only hope. But yeah, I do feel sorry for how things have kind of panned out. Also, just more for my predictions in that I said that Mazepin would be scoring regular points this year. So just for that alone, I'm disappointed. But it's never nice to see someone have a drive taken away from them for financial reasons, but equally, let's be honest, he's there for financial reasons. So you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If he was there purely on hired basis, then we would obviously feel a bit more sorry for him. People like Danny Kvyat or Arina Sidakova, who are not looking like they might not be able to apply their trade purely because where they were born just doesn't quite sit right with me. But I completely understand why this is happening. And but if we move on to slightly more happier thoughts and staying away from the global atrocities that are happening, we look forward to the season. It's looking like it's panning out to be another good season. Probably never going to match 2021, but you know, in my opinion, that was the greatest season in Formula One history. I will fight anyone who tries to tell me otherwise, despite the driver of me backing for the win didn't get it. But hey ho, that's not, you know, you can't win them all. But Predictions wise, just a bit of fun, really. If we look at the top four drivers, top four constructors for the season, what's your opinion on where they're going to end up come the end of the season in Abu Dhabi?
The issue here is you've picked the world's biggest fence sitter to come off his perch and make a choice.
And I'm going to make you give me an ironclad top four for both drivers and constructors.
Okay. Gosh, it's difficult, isn't it? Honestly, I've not really thought about it because I'm so sort of lost to the world of, we don't know what they're doing. It's hard to make a choice. Something inside me is sort of saying that Verstappen won't win it a second time around, which I'm saying now, it's going to come back to bite me. I'm going to say George Russell for the title.
Wow, excellent.
Why not?
You heard it here first.
I think if the Mercedes is good and Russell knocks it out of the park first try, why not? But honestly, on a serious note, I think probably we're looking at Hamilton's eighth title. I see Mercedes, you know, having a much better car when it comes to Bahrain, and you know, it's reliable, should be quick. He's looked like he's just kind of kicked on, and I think the sort of the pain of losing the title last time round, that's going to fuel him a lot as well. Who knows how many years he's got left, maybe two or three at max. Yeah, I think Hamilton for an eighth title, probably okay. Verstappen second, Russell third. And I'm going to say Carlos Sainz fourth.
Excellent.
If the Ferrari is everything it promises to be, I think he might beat Leclerc.
He did last year, but I mean, certainly on performances, Leclerc looked like he had the edge. For me, he's got the overall peaks, but Sainz has got the consistency. Always call him Sunday Sainz because he just does it on a Sunday. And if he can just, again, he tends to make more problems for himself in qualifying by making mistakes than Leclerc does, you know, Monaco aside. But then in the races, he tends to just get on with it. I thought he tended to be on the alternate strategy a lot for Ferrari, the one that was kind of like, well, we'll put Carlos on this and see what happens. And then he just always made it work, whereas Leclerc can't do that as well, I don't think. So I think for me, Leclerc's going to have the edge over Sainz this year, because I think he's been taken by surprise by Sainz a little bit and thought he was just brought in as not so much to be a number two, but just thought he naturally would fall into that number two position due to his ability. But for me, I'm with you for your proper prediction in with Hamilton. I would love for it to be George Russell, but I think Hamilton over the course of a season has probably got a little bit too much for him. I'm actually going bold with my top four and saying it's going to be Hamilton, and then I'm going to say Leclerc, Verstappen, Norris. I think it's going to be one of those seasons where you have the teams are going to have to make a decision and they're going to have to sacrifice one of the drivers. And I think ultimately that's going to lead to benefits for Ferrari because they're going to have a very strong car. But I think they're going to take longer to make that decision on who they're going to back because they're not used to being in that position. And I think Hamilton will take the lead over Russell, and then obviously Verstappen naturally will just take the lead over Perez. That's my top four. It's a bit bold, four drivers from four different teams in the top four. But I reckon as well, you know, going into certainly the penultimate race of the season, those four drivers will all be in with a shot of the title. That's what I'm going with.
That's bold. No. I hope so. I really hope so.
That
would be fantastic. Four teams in it. Formula One, I think especially after last year, it'd be absolutely great.
Yeah, even if it's not as exciting a season, certainly to have that, because we've had it before. We've had four drivers going for the title in the last race. But do you remember what happened in Abu Dhabi 2012? I know Vettel won it, but
So it was 2010.
Was it 2010? Sorry, yeah, 2010. Vettel. Yeah.
And then Alonso was stuck behind Petrov forever. But yeah.
That's right, yeah. And it was just Webber and Button or Hamilton, maybe. I can't remember now. But yeah, it's just, that's the thing. Four drivers in with a title shot on the last race of the season. You'd think we'd be talking about it forever, but we just don't.
No.
It just nothing really happened in it. So yeah, I'm hoping that that's kind of rectified this year and we have an exciting title battle with more than two drivers. Obviously, nothing's really ever going to match last season, but hey-ho. So going on to constructors, I think we all finally had that question answered last year of what's more important. The teams will always say the constructors is more important, but when it comes to the championship, the drivers' championship is clearly what they want. I think both Mercedes and Red Bull proved that completely without doubt last year. But constructors wise what's your thoughts on that? I can probably make a guess based on your driver choices, but go on then. Top four, no fence sitting, top four constructors.
I think it'll probably be the same as last year, and I'll go Mercedes, Red Bull, Ferrari, McLaren, but I kind of hope there might be a surprise fifth team. I'm not 100% sure if anyone's got it in them to be that fifth team. Maybe in terms of consistency, AlphaTauri, but in terms of the final day of testing, God, I'd love to say Williams. That would be so good. But I think it might be a stretch too far.
Yeah, I think top four, that's going to be difficult. It'd be nice, the midfield to just have the second field. You know, if you had the top four and then everyone else just fighting out, that'd be fine. I mean, to be honest, I'd be fine with just like having it very similar to how we have it in IndyCar and again in Formula E, where you just don't know who's going to win each race. Not quite to the extremes that we saw last year in Formula E, but no. certainly like the IndyCar model, without having a spec series, the way that they go about racing, and that you know they say that it's a good result if you finish seventh. If Lewis Hamilton finished seventh in Bahrain, it'd be a disaster. You know, so if we can get to a position where seventh place in a race isn't a disaster for someone in a championship hunt, then that'll be a good place to sit. I'm going to go bold again on this and say that Ferrari win the Constructors' Championship. And then it would be Mercedes second, I think as much as I want it to be a good season, Ricciardo, I think it's going to be Red Bull third, McLaren fourth, but that's mostly going to be down to Ricciardo. And then extra prediction on top of that, we then have Pato Award in there for the following season. But that does get very very convoluted, and a lot of things have got to happen before that happens. It certainly would be fun. I don't necessarily think it'd happen, but I think for Formula One it'd be an interesting thing. So moving on then to one last point then. So who's going to win Bahrain?
Oh god!
Who's going to be quickest? Or certainly quickest in Bahrain. I'll let you off to say who's going to win. Who's going to be the quick? Who's going to be the team to beat in Bahrain?
I'm going to sort of bring this back to 2019, where Charles Leclerc was very, very close to winning before everything kind of went wrong and he lost power, and he still finished third. So I'm going to say, I might say Leclerc. Okay. If the Ferrari's good.
Yeah, I think Mercedes will be quickest. Whether they win or not, it's who knows. But I think they'll be the quickest. Have you got any other bold predictions, any surprise winners or podiums or anything like that you want to throw in just for good measure?
I think we'll see a Williams on the podium again this year. This time on merit rather than
that'd be nice.
The race is cancelled after two laps because it's too wet. Gosh, I think Haas points. I think I think on balance we'll end up seeing Pietro Fittipaldi in the other car. Which is probably a less inspiring choice than Piastri, but he's there, and it'll be a very sort of a weird transition. But yeah, I think Haas will probably be back on the point scorers again. Everyone will score points. Well, all teams, sorry. Any bold, massively bold predictions? Lance Stroll to win a race.
I can actually see that happening. I can see that happening. He's a solid driver. He's a solid driver now, but he's had 6 years to learn his trade. So he's put him in a winning car. It's where these people that they come through the racing formulas, they try their they apply their trade learning how to win races. Everyone who's in Formula One knows how to win a race. Ocon winning in Hungary was probably one of the easiest races he had that season because the seas parted, and then all he had to do was do what he can do best, drive fast in without having to fight anyone, and obviously just having to keep Vettel behind him. So probably one of the easier races. So certainly if he's got a car where he can get into that position to win a race, then I have no doubt he will close that out, provided he's not put under undue pressure. You know, nothing like when to come in for intermediates and or anything like that, or you know, having a car chasing him down on much younger tyres, for example. If it's just a case of he ends up in the lead, then I've no doubt that Lance Stroll could close out a race win, because he's definitely got that much talent to be able to do that. Just going back slightly to the question mark of the other Haas drive, you'd be a good person to ask this given your Formula E connections. Another name banded around is Antonio Giovinazzi. What are your thoughts on that? How airtight is that deal? Because I know it's not started too well for him.
There is one thing about Dragon, which is it keeps its drivers under lock and key. And I believe that its other driver, Sergio Sette Câmara, tried to find a way out of the team because it's not been particularly strong. There's been a huge turnover in sort of backroom staff, but you know, he couldn't find a way out because, you know, Jay Penske owns his soul, basically. So I think for Giovinazzi, it depends on how tight that contract is. And I can imagine it is probably quite tight, because Dragon perhaps foresaw, you know, if he didn't like it after a couple of races, then he'd be on his way. So it depends how much they can get for him. It also depends how much influence Ferrari has in this as well. If they can, if they have him on a leash, that they can just sort of pull him away and pop him in the Haas. He'd be a strong option, a solid option, certainly. You know, he didn't impress massively at Alfa Romeo, but he did have good days. And I think, you know, if you want someone that's a bit plug in and play, then he'd be a very, very good option. But yeah, it totally depends on whether Dragon would be willing to let him go and whether they'd be able to find a replacement in time. Especially because the next race coming up is Rome. Would Antonio want to miss his home round? I don't know. We'll have to see.
I think given the start that he's made and then he offered a Formula One seat in a much more competitive Haas, I think he would rip your arm off personally. But yeah, if we'll move on to do a little bit of Formula E chat, if that's okay with you, because obviously you say you're the on-the-ground reporter for Formula E this year. What does that involve? And what's it like having to balance between two complete formulas like this?
So generally that is going to all the races, asking the drivers annoying questions, reporting on all the races, being in the paddock, and sniffing out news, essentially. So that's sort of like the general bread and butter.
So you're like the Ted Kravitz of Formula E, is that correct? Or
that... with less sandals, certainly. I don't wear shorts in the paddock either. But yeah, it's just trying to produce all of the content for Autosport and motorsport.com, features as well. So basically sort of it's basically my wheelhouse, really. With balancing both of it is tough. I do a little bit less Formula One stuff now, just sort of focused on the technical bits and pieces. Obviously we've not really had a crossover in weekends yet, but we'll see. I think it'll be the Australian Grand Prix where it will be where I get to miss out on getting up at 1 a.m. for FP1, which I'm very happy about. But it's quite a lot of work, but at the same time it gets me out of the house, and It's good fun. It's a completely different paddock, Formula E. It's a lot more similar to Formula 2 or Formula 3. It's sort of less polished than Formula 1, but at the same time, access to drivers is so much easier. You can honestly just sort of hang around the back of the garage and just grab somebody rather than having to set something up and wait several days in advance for an interview with, you know, Pierre Gasly or somebody. You know, it's a lot easier in terms of access for Formula E, which I think is a good thing. And yeah, as you say, you don't know who's going to win the races. I think the new qualifying system has sort of changed that a little bit. There's a bit more of an order. But at the same time, I don't know if anybody expected Pascal Wehrlein to win the race in Mexico, but Porsche knocked it out of the park. And yeah, it's going to be a really interesting title fight between, you know, them, I think Mercedes, Venturi, and maybe Jaguar if they can get their heads back in the game.
I think as well, I think it's a good thing with the Formula E qualifying system, as you mentioned, because there's a certain amount of credibility that comes with being a bona fide world championship. And Formula E has always been very happy to try these gimmicks and try different things to create exciting races. But you know, they've got to grow up at some point and be this world championship series. And I think having that qualifying format, I've only been following Formula E for a couple of years. I think 3 seasons. It was first race I actually watched was Stoffel Vandoorne's debut, and so that's how long I've been following it. And so from day one, I've despised that qualifying format, and it just doesn't. It's just not right. It's not racing for me. So I'm glad it's gone. I'm glad they've put something in there. Although it's a bit convoluted and a bit difficult to understand, at least it does kind of, it's exciting, and the fast drivers fight it out for the pole, which I think is the right way to do it. You can tell by my comments here that I'm not a fan of reverse grid races or anything like that. So no. It's you know, it's fun in Formula 2, but I think it gives away too many points for me. Anyway, this is not about Formula 2, this is about Formula E. What would you say? Obviously, I've touched on now about the gimmicks and the excitement of everything of Formula E. What would you say then are the pros and cons of each series? Because everyone talks about Formula One. We all know it's not perfect, and Formula E perhaps unfairly does get a bit of a bad rap. And I do think Formula E is a lot better than a lot of people give it credit for. So, what's your opinion on that? What's the pros and cons of each series?
I think the big pros in Formula E from my personal perspective is kind of access, but also knowing that you're going to get a good race. And even if you come into it completely out of context, you know that you're going to see overtakes, you're going to see a little bit of sort of that rubbings racing mentality. You kind of know that you're going to get that. I think the cons are when it's so geared towards a sort of energy management series that you see these sort of lulls in the mid period of the race where people are energy saving towards something towards the end. And that can sometimes work in some drivers' favors and sometimes it doesn't. We saw in Mexico, for example, that Porsche did quite a lot of heavy energy saving at the start of the race, which is kind of exciting because, you know, I guess it wasn't exciting for them because they were being overtaken, but they knew they had something in hand for later and they pushed the race sort of lap past what everyone else was expecting, and then everyone was having these problems and falling back, and it's kind of interesting to see that, but I wouldn't say it's necessarily a good look. Whereas with Formula One, I think one of the cons is it's a little bit of a closed shop, but I think they're doing some really big things to change that, obviously with Netflix, obviously with, you know, the changes in access that fans are getting. It's getting a lot better. Again, maybe the racing is something that still needs working on, but again, we've not seen these new cars to see how they do. But I think, you know, the big pro of Formula One is it is Formula One. It's such a massive, massive global entity, and it's got so much draw and it's got so much of a pull. And it's obviously something that everybody looks forward to every weekend. I think one of the sort of issues now that is maybe, well, a personal issue for me is maybe the calendar's too big, for example, and the races sort of feel a little bit paint by numbers now. But at the same time, you can't help but get excited for it. It's just got this massive magnetic draw to it, which I really like. But it's just, I think they're just two very, very different series at the end of the day. If you know, you can, I guess you can like them both.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one thing I do like about motorsport in this way. It's not like your football and everything where you can only support one team. And it's like even just looking at a graphic I saw about IndyCar a couple of days ago, Romain Grosjean being the most popular driver in IndyCar, and then fourth on the list was no favourite. That was for me the biggest thing there, that people just, they didn't have a favorite driver. They just, and I admit I watch it, and I cheer for Pato O'Ward, or I cheer for Alex Rossi, or I'll cheer for Jack Harvey being British. And so I don't have a favorite driver, or I don't have a favorite team. And I think it can be a bit more like that in Formula One, but again, with Formula E, you can like these different series and enjoy them and be excited by them without feeling like, you know, you're cheating on your wife because you're cheering on you're cheering on Andretti in Formula E, or you're cheering on, you know, Dragon in Formula E. It's not for me. Formula E is not quite the finished article yet. Things like what happened in, was it Valencia last year with the energy issues and that kind of thing was quite embarrassing for the sport. But then they've got on the flip side, you know, the Monaco Grand Prix was absolutely brilliant, and it's certainly a work in progress, and I'm just really looking forward to seeing what the Gen 3 brings as well. But bringing it back to Formula 1, I'll just ask your opinion on one more thing before we go. There's the talk about Andretti coming into Formula 1 potentially, kind of certainly something to talk about. And there's rumors about Formula One just don't want them, and which just for me just seems very baffling. But have you heard anything to the contrary on that? What's your thoughts on it?
First of all, I'd love to see Andretti in Formula One. I think a lot of people would. I think a lot of people love the sort of feeling of having a new team on the grid. It's always a really sort of fun moment. It's one that in modern years we've not really had a lot of. I don't know whether Formula One wants Andretti or not. It's completely up to the FIA to open up the tender process. And I think it would have to be a sort of process like that. And I think it was the same for Haas as well back in 2015, which they were originally going to enter for. It's very confusing. Obviously, the sale to from Sauber didn't go through, because Sauber's shareholders didn't want to give up a certain level of control, and Andretti wanted to buy 100% of the team. They've said before, and maybe this will change depending on the finances of the team, but you know, they've said they've tried to buy Haas before, but Haas wasn't willing to sell. So I guess their only option is to try and set up as one team. Mercedes and Red Bull have said we'll accept them if they can prove that they're credible. McLaren, obviously, Zak Brown has worked with Michael Andretti on numerous occasions. Done so in Aussie Supercars, for example. Done so in Indy 500 entries and things like that. That, you know, they know each other very well. So Zak Brown says, you know, of course they're credible. They're a fantastic force across motorsport, in Formula E, in Supercars, Extreme E, IndyCar, various other categories. I think it would be great personally. It is completely up to the FIA whether they take them on. It's a huge amount of capital involved. They would have to pay $200 million, which is split among all of $200 million, which would be split among all the teams. And then it would be the costs to set up a team and then working to a budget of what will be next year, $135 million cost cap. So there's a lot of money involved.
Plus driver salary as well.
I think it would be great, and I would love to see it. But does F1 want another team? The jury is still out on that one, I think.
Yeah, I think for me, 12 teams seems right. 11 is great. 10 always seems a little bit small, but it's fine because it's Formula One. As long as you've got 10 competitive teams, I wouldn't want them to come in and be another HRT, you know, four seconds a lap off the pace or whatever. But I'm pretty sure they wouldn't do that, especially if they've got a Renault power deal set up or whatever they've got organised. Would be I think it would be good for Formula One. I really do, and it would certainly help with their presence in America, which is already, you know, it's growing by the day. But certainly, I think it would be a good thing for Formula One. I just want to say as well, thank you very much for coming on today. It was an absolute pleasure talking to you about the Formula One regulations. And is there anywhere that people can go to catch up from more of the stuff that you do? And obviously, there's the Autosport website, the Autosport podcast. But where can people follow you and learn more about you?
About me personally, I'll get on to that in a minute. Obviously, we've got the Autosport YouTube channel as well, as motorsport.com, for all of our sort of friends from other regional editions and that sort of thing. My Twitter work account, I keep my personal Twitter account a little bit hidden, but my obviously, if people want to follow me on Twitter, it is JBL Autosport, where I usually just post F1 related memes and that kind of thing. And follow us on Autosport. We've got loads of staff, got loads of great authors and writers and that kind of thing. So we've got so much going for us, which is really good. So yeah, give us a follow.
Yeah, you can also give us a follow as well. Please consider supporting us on Patreon from as little as $1, and so that can help us get better microphones and less cats in the background here as well. A cage for my cats would be nice. We are available on all major podcasting platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon Music, Verbal, OmniStudio and Pocket Cast, as well as being available on the F1 Chronicle website too. All our shows for our reviews go out live, and anything with that requires reaction to events goes out live. And we also have our post-show live chat for any questions. If you want to join us on that, just search for F1 Chronicle on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell so you know when we're live. We will be back soon for more Formula One Grid Talk. Thank you very much for watching. Goodbye.